17 seconds and counting. Guidance internal. 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9. We have ignition sequence start. Engines on. 5, 4, 3, 2. All engines running.
Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are willing to postpone, and one we intend to win.
Okay, engine stop. ATA at a descent. Flight control mode auto, descent engine command override off. Engine arm on. 413 is in.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Today's Cosmic Perspective interview is with Dr. Vera Rubin. Despite having to overcome the obstacles that women faced with interests in science and participating in a field predominantly occupied by men at the time, Dr. Rubin made one of the most important discoveries of the 20th century, a discovery that continues to impact our understanding of the structure of the universe. I hope you enjoy my 2009 interview with Dr. Vera Rubin as much as I did. Today's guest on Cosmic Perspective is Dr. Vera Rubin. Dr. Rubin received a PhD in astronomy from Georgetown University. She wrote her thesis under George Gamow at George Washington University and has been on the staff of the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism since 1965. Dr. Rubin, thanks for being on Cosmic Perspective.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Today I'd like to discuss how your interest in motion of stars and other galaxies enlightened, or should I say, darkened the field of astronomy. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about how this all got started.
After I got my degree at Georgetown, I stayed on and taught for about 10 years. I had two children when I got my degree, a husband and two children. And I had two more children, and then I started observing, and I decided that the difficulties of observing and teaching and having a family were so great that I had to let one of them go, and I really enjoyed the observing and finding things that no one had known before, so I walked in and asked for a job at the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism. This is one of the Carnegie Institution of Washington's research organizations, and they had never hired a woman before. They were founded in 1902 by Andrew Carnegie, and initially they had sailed the seas and mapped the magnetic field of the Earth, but that stopped in 1927 when the ship, 27 or 29, the ship went down in port in Pango Pango, and they never did terrestrial magnetism after that. So it was just really a research lab where they, and still is, where you can very much do what you want once they hire you. And quite a remarkable place, and I owe a lot to the fact that they did hire me. I think until the Second World War, even the secretaries were male, partly from the Navy tradition. So hiring a woman was a new feature for them. And in fact, I should probably say that the day I started work, someone from the office had to come down and ask me how I spelled my name because not one single piece of paper had taken place. They just had asked me to give a talk one day when I was there, and that's how I got the job.
Amazing.
So because I had a family, I should back up and say the first thing, when I came here, I did not even know that someone had been working on a new instrument for telescopes. This is called an image tube. It was a way of enhancing the incoming light so you could get a picture or a spectrum of what you wanted to see in about one-tenth of the time that a normal telescope would take. So instead of taking 10 hours to do something, we could do it in an hour. And I knew that having a family and going observing was not impossible, but difficult, that I didn't want to work in a field that other people were doing. At that time, learning about quasi-stellar objects, quasars, was what all astronomers with good telescopes were doing. And I decided to study the rotation properties of the Andromeda galaxy, the nearest galaxy to us. That had been done a few times in the history of astronomy, starting way back in the 20s and 30s and 40s, but people could never get very far out. Astronomers could only get motions of stars very close to the center of the galaxy because they were the brightest stars. And so it was principally having instrumentation that people hadn't had before and knowing what I wanted to do with it that made it possible. And so I started studying how stars orbit in galaxies.
So this image intensifier actually, you're able to see much fainter stars.
That's right. Yes. That's right. And we could go much farther out and with much greater certainty. Most of the earlier studies tried going further out. But in fact, what astronomers typically had done up till that time, because in the solar system, as you get further and further away from the star, from the sun, planets further and further away orbit more slowly because the gravitational effect falls off with distance. And so people always assumed that the same thing would happen in a galaxy. So if they had even a half a dozen points near the center, then they would put in the kind of fall-off that they were used to seeing in the solar system, actually an inverse square law. And they just thought that's the way things were. And we discovered from our very first study of Andromeda that, in fact, once you got past the center where funny things might be happening, then the velocities never decreased. They're almost always the same all across the galaxy. And we were actually able to go beyond what you see as the bright galaxy, again, because of the image tube. And we call this a rotation curve, the curve that shows the velocity as a function of distance from the center. So we published our first rotation curve about 1970, the rotation curve of Andromeda. And then about 5 years later, radio astronomers were able to go about a third farther, and they matched our velocities exactly and continued again perfectly straight, same velocity as far out as you could go. And ultimately, we had maybe 60, 70 rotation curves toward the end of the 1970s. And every galaxy, virtually every galaxy we ever observed, had velocities that just stayed constant. as you went further and further from the center of the galaxy.
So the data from radio astronomy was matching up with the data of your observational astronomy.
That's right.
And so these rotation arcs were not acting as you expected them to.
Well, that's right. I mean, we all grew up with Newton's laws, and Newton was one of the first scientists in the, well, I'm not sure I can give a correct date, so I won't, but several centuries ago. Based on planets, it was believed that it was understood, gravity was understood as a force that decreased with the inverse square as you went further and further away, and so the velocities fell. And that wasn't what we observed at all. So by the late 1970s, astronomers had certainly believed it. There was no doubt about the observations. I mean, I think it's a correct statement to say that even today, there are many things we don't understand, but there's no question about the observations. So in order to satisfy the classical laws of rotation, it means that the mass of the galaxy, the amount of matter, say, in each ring as you go further and further from the center, has to have just as much mass as each interior ring. It's a very special distribution of matter, and that has to happen in order to have a flat rotation curve. And probably 99.5% of the astronomical community believes that that's the explanation of the rotation curve, that there's just matter that is not dark, and it's distributed in this special way, and that's what's keeping the orbits of the individual stars so high.
This was over a period of more than 10 years, it seems, before the concept of dark matter was accepted. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yes. Right. I mean, for the first half dozen years or so, it was a puzzle. And I think it's true to say that no one doubted the observations because they really were very clean and very clear. There is a small community of the physics and astronomy community, and that's like 0.5%, that believes, in fact, that there is no dark matter and that Newton's laws just don't hold for distances as great as the outsides of galaxies. And they have made mathematical models that satisfy the observations, but they don't satisfy most of the physicists who really, and there are very good reasons to believe that there is black matter, dark matter, but I don't think it should be forgotten. I mean, in science you don't get what you like, but what I would like would be somehow a merging of the two ideas. I mean, maybe we can't live in a universe that does two different things, but it seems very peculiar to me that there is a way of understanding it that does not require dark matter.
I see. So they're using the same data that you're using.
Yes. Okay. They're using exactly the same data. I mean, I sometimes wonder, although I think I know the answer, you know, if I had started out by saying, I'm going to test Newton's law by observing rotation curves of lots of galaxies, and then I had seen that they didn't work, would I have immediately said, okay, that means Newton's laws don't hold at these very large distances. I mean, we learned early from Einstein that Newton's laws don't hold very close to the center of a galaxy. I mean, yes. So they had to be, this was the precession of Mercury. Mercury's orbit didn't obey exactly Newton's laws. And Einstein, one of the first evidences that Einstein's theory of gravitation, of relativity, was correct, was his explanation of the orbit of Mercury.
He could actually predict the orbit, where I believe before the orbit was not able to be predicted. Is that correct?
No, the orbit was predicted, but it was the period. It was some very small fraction, like 0.5 of, I've really forgotten the numbers, maybe 0.5, that Mercury in one orbit ended up a tiny bit ahead of where it would have been under Newton's laws.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And so that each orbit, it gained this 0.5 arc seconds, I think, was the unit. I remember the number, but it was just a very, very small fraction of the orbit. And in fact, early on, I mean, in the end of the 19th century or whatever, many people thought, astronomers thought there might be a planet interior to Mercury that would explain this
change in gravitational. So I didn't realize it was that small.
It is very small.
So the most widely accepted theory, basically, is that there is dark matter there at this point.
Yes.
Right.
And there are other reasons for believing it also. We see that astronomers, in taking pictures of massive clusters of galaxies, have discovered that there are strange arcs in their photograph. Instead of a picture of a galaxy, they have all the galaxies, but then they have arcs around the picture often. And they now understand that these are background galaxies and clusters of galaxies. The best images come when they're about twice as far as the galaxy you're studying. And this is gravitational lensing. And that also gives you a way to measure the mass in the foreground galaxy.
The bending of light around?
Around the foreground galaxy. And that fits into their models. So that's one of the other evidence.
The next question I have, and it's probably the biggest question everyone has, and that is, well, what could dark matter be?
It is something that does not have light as its one of its properties. It is not that we're just not seeing the light. It is something that we don't know. Physicists especially have periodically believed that it must be one of the particles that they have in their theories of matter, and one by one, every particle they've studied turns out, which they had studied previously, but now if they try and understand the dark matter in terms of that particle, they find out that it won't work, or it won't work at least past the 5%. That is, you couldn't have enough dark matter from that particle. Maybe you would require 100%, and maybe you can get 5% of the... I mean, they can't rule out that at a very, very low level, a particle is what they're detecting,
Just a fraction of mass compared
yeah,
to...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that would be a mess if it turned out to be 20 things, each of which contributed 5% of what you need. So I think the idea at the present time, we are in a position where we've been before, and that is particle physicists, the experimental physicists, believe that the new detector they're building is going to solve this problem. I think the first conference I ever went to on dark matter was in 1979 at Harvard. And there the particle physicists all said that we'd know in 10 years. And every 5 years, someone says, sometimes the same person, says we'll know in 10 years. And now they say we'll know in 5 years. And I've heard physicists whose names I could mention in 2000 say we'll know in 5 years. And now in 2004, they said we'd know in 5 years and so forth.
When you answer one question that you have, maybe through observational data, you probably have 10 more questions
that
arise.
Of course, that's the way science goes. But, I mean, this is a long time. 1980, certainly, we knew that we had to learn something. And many, many problems in physics and astronomy have gotten solved in less time. So now everyone's waiting for the big collider in Switzerland. And I think if that doesn't turn up what the particle is, we need a whole new reconsideration. I'm getting too old. I want to know what it is.
But we do know through observations that less than 10% of the matter in the universe is visible, and
that's
that
right.
90%, more than 90% of the matter is dark matter or invisible.
That's right.
So we do at least know that, and that's an incredible thing to think about in itself, that there is more than 90% of the universe that we don't even see.
That's correct. But no one ever told us we were going to understand the whole universe during our lifetimes. I mean, what will the people in 3000 say about our science? Andromeda is the closest galaxy to us, and that's why it was the first galaxy we studied. Because it's therefore the brightest. The earliest image we have of Andromeda is a sketch, a drawing in 1000, I think in Persia. They draw the constellation around. The constellation is a fish, and then there's a fuzzy thing that the fish is about to swallow. And that fuzzy thing is what we now call Andromeda. So in 1,000 years, we're going from a little fuzz in the sky, and essentially none of the physics or astronomy that we know now, and of course none of the instrumentation, so an enormous change has taken place in the last 1,000 years, and I don't know. I am certainly not one that thinks that we've learned everything or almost everything. I think there must be monumental surprises that still lie ahead.
I have to ask you a question, and that is, was it more difficult to find that the dark matter exists, or was it more difficult to overcome the obstacles of being a woman in the field of astronomy? I know that's not probably
They're sort of orthogonal to each other. I mean, I have no idea. It is true that, I mean, they're not disconnected, the two things. I studied galaxies and outsides of galaxies because I was very interested in them. I mean, it seemed to me this was a complete unknown. I knew that astronomers always drew these Keplerian, or whatever you want to call them, these inverse square laws, falls. And it seemed to me that that was the subject that really needed to be investigated. And it wasn't so much as being a woman, really, by that time in my career, but it was just that I lived in Washington and I had to fly away to go observing, and I didn't go observing very much, and I really didn't want to compete with people that had much more telescope time. So it was partly a very a decision that I made after just thinking about it. I was very interested in knowing how stars orbited, but I really wanted to do something that nobody would bother me with while I was, I mean, they wouldn't. I should back up a couple minutes and say that when I first came to DTM and we had this image tube, the first couple of observing runs I went on, we looked at QSOs, at quasi-stellar objects, because we could do these much more rapidly and we could see into the infrared, and it just had lots of advantages. And by then I knew a fair number of people in the astronomical world, and they were friends, and they would call me and ask me if I had observed such and such because they were going observing, and if I hadn't, they would do it, and if I had, they wouldn't do it. And you know, sometimes I had done it and wasn't quite sure what I saw, and I just didn't want to do something that I didn't, it wasn't even a question of competition, it's just that I didn't want people continually asking me what I had gotten and what I hadn't gotten, and so I really decided to pick the rotation and galaxies because I thought that was something that no one would care about while I was doing it, but I hoped that when I was done, they'd be happy to see the result. I mean, that was a very conscious decision. Maybe men don't have to make decisions. I mean, I'm not sure that it really is related to sex. I think my hardest problems with being a woman were being in school, in college, in high school. Many, many times I was told to go find something else to study, and that didn't bother me at all.
But I understand that you were the first woman to legally observe at the Mount Palomar Observatory.
That's right.
And what year was that?
1965. Yeah. Margaret Burbidge, who was the wife of a physicist astronomer, had observed there illegally because her husband had time on the telescope, and people knew she was doing it, but they wouldn't let her live in the dormitory, and they, you know, she couldn't behave as a normal. And I don't know how much time she really spent doing that, but she certainly did it once or twice.
It's been almost a half a century since then. Is the percentage of women in astronomy today still small compared to men?
No. At the present time, they're creeping up. I cannot tell you an accurate number, but in the last decade, probably, the number of women in physics and astronomy in college is certainly approaching that of men. And it even is very high at the postdoc level. And then it starts to fall. They don't get permanent jobs. I mean, there's a real discontinuity. I hope it's changing. But
Do you think that's political, or do you think it's...
Well, I don't know. I mean, getting tenure seems to be very difficult, and many of them drop out. They don't get the jobs that the men get.
And to stay in a postdoc position for a long period of time is, I'm sure, very difficult to do.
Well, I don't think people do it after... I mean, postdocs are generally 3 years, sometimes only 2 years. And I think sometimes they get a second postdoc because they don't get a job. But after a second postdoc, if you can't get a job, you're really in a difficult position in astronomy. You know, I have to say one more thing. I'd like to say one more thing before I quit. And that is, the most important thing I did in my life was to marry the right man. He did more than support me. He encouraged me all along the way. If I would say, oh, how can I possibly, you know, go off to such and such or go to a meeting or do this, he would say, well, of course you can, and he would make it possible. He would care for the children. I used to cook a turkey every time I went away, and then because I would go observing 3 or 4 times a year, and then the kids started begging no more turkeys, and then he would take them to the Chinese restaurant, and after a while they were saying no more Chinese food. But he really, I mean, I think that's an important thing to tell all women that want to be maybe professionals in any field. One important thing is to marry someone who will help you make it possible.
Well, thanks again very much, Dr. Rubin. Invitation is always open to be on again if you'd like to.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I think you're doing a wonderful thing, and I hope there are lots of good fruits from it.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
The impact of Dr. Rubin's discovery was so great that the term dark matter has become synonymous with the understanding of the rotation of stars around galaxies. I'm Andy Pineros. Thanks for listening to this 365 Days of Astronomy podcast.